Welcome and thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik Palmgren and today we are talking with Barbara Oakley. She is a fellow of the American Institute of Medical and Biological Engineers. Currently, she is an associate professor of engineering at Oakland University in Michigan, and she has written 5 books. Underlying the work is Oakley's scientific training and research related to medical imaging and genetics, precisely the areas where important breakthroughs in brain research are being made. She is with us today to talk about her latest book, Pathological Altruism. The benefits of altruism and empathy are obvious. These qualities are so highly regarded and embedded in both secular and religious societies that it seems almost heretical to suggest that they can cause harm. But like most good things, altruism can be distorted or taken to an unhealthy extreme. Pathologies of altruism and empathy not only underlie health issues, but also a disparate slew of humankind's most troubled features, including genocide, suicide bombing, self-righteous political partisanship, and ineffective philanthropic and social programs that ultimately worsen the situations that they are meant to aid. I think one could make a pretty strong case, arguing that the majority of the problems we see in the world are created by people who think they're doing the right thing. I think very few wake up in the morning with a fiery intention of spreading evil, murder, mayhem, and pain and suffering in the world. Maybe there are a few of those sick individuals out there, but I believe that the majority are naive idealists who, through their philanthropic, charitable, and humanitarian work, have become blinded by self-righteousness, and they lack the self-reflection or the awareness to realize the true impact of their so-called good work. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. We're very glad to have you with us. Thank you for taking some time off and talking about your work with us here today.
Henrik, it's such a pleasure to be here. I'm glad to be on Red Ice.
Excellent. Now, you have a very interesting series of books that I think hold a lot of important ideas and points, and we're going to get into that today. Cold-Blooded Kindness, one of your titles, Evil Genes, and now your latest is called Pathological Altruism. I think that this is kind of the, I guess, overarching theme of your work, what you've been writing about now the last few years. It's a subject we don't hear too much about, unfortunately, and we're going to get into this in more detail, of course. But as I understand it, you're an associate professor of engineering at the Detroit area, Oakland University. So how did you develop an interest with the kind of subjects that you write about currently?
Well, I think it comes from my background. Before I became an academician, I did a lot of different things. I worked at the South Pole Station as a radio operator, and that's where I met my husband. I always say I had to go to the ends of the earth to meet that man. I used to work as a Russian translator on Soviet trawlers. I went from private to regular army captain in the military, and then I got my doctorate in systems engineering. And so what that did for me was it gave me a wide variety of different perspectives, as well as a solid scientific background. So what that meant was when I take an interest in something, it's usually something that is that I'm looking at in a way that people don't usually look at it, and that's simply because of this broad perspective. For me, I'm always fascinated by what makes people tick, and so all of my works pertain to that.
Excellent. Now, so give us a description or an outline, I guess, of what you mean by pathological altruism for those who might not even understand the terminology here, Barbara.
Well, the bottom line for me is I think altruism is a very important idea, and it's a concept that I try to live up to. I try to help others. That's what altruism is. It's often helping others at some cost to yourself. But sometimes the bottom line is we can have perceptions that we are helping others, but if you take a step back and you look at it, your helping efforts can actually sometimes, perhaps surprisingly, make things worse. And so that's what I wanted to explore with pathological altruism, this idea that we get this certainty, this sense of certainty in our minds that we're doing something right to help others, and it actually can be worsening the situation in some circumstances.
Indeed. Now, if we go back a little bit in history to talk about the subject, I kind of wanted to ask you, what do you think, what part, rather, religion holds in all this? And specifically, I guess we could look at Christianity as well, considering that the main deity, Jesus Christ, basically sacrificed himself for all of us. This is basically the pinnacle of altruism, right? So is this a religious programming that we have inherently, or where does this idea come from, Barbara?
Well, religion, interestingly enough, evolved. It's thought that it evolved within us, that propensity to have spiritual inclinations, because it truly is helpful for people in general. It helps people band together, have some of the same basic concepts. Obviously, it helps protect the weak sometimes. And even when a government is bad, for example, a totalitarian government, religion can sometimes be used as a bulwark against that. It can help people know that, hey, the government isn't the only answer. There's something greater than that, perhaps. So religion can be a very powerful force for good. Of course, it can also be overtaken by people who have other aims, and it can be used for bad. But overall, as with many beliefs and political systems, I think religion is something that helps people get together to try and, in general, help others.
Indeed. How far back do you go when it comes to some of the other ideas of altruism and where this comes from? I've always been fascinated with this because there is a balance to the subject, as you're alluding to, obviously, in your work as well, that one can... When one sacrifices, you know, themselves too much, that's being, you know, it's not good for yourself to do that, basically. But the fact is, you can also you do it too little, so the fact is that you might become looked upon as selfish in society and by your peers and all that. What is a good balance in all this, do you think, Barbara?
Oh, that's a terrific question. I think, well, for one end, let's explore this just a little bit. On one end, you can have people who tend towards codependency. And these are individuals who they care a lot about other people, and they're very empathetic for the needs of others. In fact, they can be so empathetic that it's hard for them to set boundaries and turn off the needs of others and realize that, you know, in the long run, they themselves have to count some too, because if they don't take into account their own wants and needs, it can be unhealthy for everyone. So part of my work explores this idea that altruism for others is great, but you can't climb on board and treat it as if it was this sort of cult-like all good thing that is never bad, because sometimes caring for others can be bad, and it's always going to be different in different circumstances as to where you draw that line. But I think the beginning of drawing that line is simply the realization that if you are too caring for others, it's easy for others to take advantage of you. And you can just burn out, and that's not good for anyone.
Well, I've always said, to be able to help others, you have to help yourself first. You must make sure that you're in a situation where you have the capability of helping others, right? And this works on so many different levels, but it seems like sometimes in society, it seems like the right thing to do is just, again, to throw down your own life for everybody else. But that can actually be even worse. It can even be more detrimental. There's a number of examples we can take from that, but the fact is that if, let's say, somebody has a job or a task to fulfill, which enables people to, let's say they're a farmer, right? They're farming food and crops and everything else. If they would quit their job, so to speak, to give up this role that they have in society to be able to help another person. In the long run, this would mean, I mean, I'm making a simplified example here, obviously, but this would mean that this person can no longer supply food and work for the farms as usual, and therefore in the long term, this will actually be detrimental to even more people. But this person has now sacrificed their life, in a sense, or their time to help just one individual out. So it might be detrimental to the greater good. What do you think about a scenario like that, Barbara? Because it's very tricky, again, to know where to draw the line. Where do I step in? Where do I put the time in to help everybody else? And what's the most important thing, right?
I love that example, because that example gives a good picture of how, on an individual basis, your one reaction where you think you're helping others, and perhaps you are, is actually hurting people on a greater societal level. An example that's sort of similar, but I don't know if it's quite as good, but it's a little bit more personal, is just someone who is very giving to their next-door neighbor. And then their next-door neighbor continues to take advantage and take advantage of your own good nature until, after a while, people look at you and say, wait a minute, where's the time for you and your family and your family's needs? I think it's hard for someone who is very, very good-natured and very empathetic to realize that there are other people who naturally will take advantage of that kind of set of characteristics.
Indeed. Now, if we were to talk about those people a little bit who take advantage of this, is this something more that maybe connects with your work on evil genes, perhaps? The fact that we have people who are, they understand that they're dealing with people who are willing to sacrifice themselves and therefore completely take advantage of this and I mean, if they do that, most people maybe that are in this position do that knowingly, maybe. And so, how do we categorize these people, if so, Barbara?
Well, my first book along psychological lines was "Evil Genes: Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, Enron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend," and she really did, and it got me to wondering, what is the biology underlying why there are sort of malevolent people who take advantage of other people. And it turns out it's a combination of environment, of your genetic underpinnings. It's a lot of different things, but it can help create people who are extremely narcissistic and will easily take advantage of anyone else, and they can always justify that because of their own narcissism, right? It's their own needs are much more important. And they're simply wired to think that way. So as I went around the country talking about this book and the ramifications of these ideas, people would ask me, they'd say, hey, look, we can kind of understand that someone like Hitler, say, would have a biological screw loose, so to speak, and that's why he did some of the extremely malevolent things that he did. But what about all the Germans? I mean, they weren't all evil. So how did they follow someone like that? And that's when I began to realize that part of what's going on is often people get looped into causes not because they're bad people. On the contrary, it's because they're so good and they'll climb on board something that can be sold to them as being for everyone's good, that it's a positive thing. And you can in a sense, you're buying people's souls when you tell them what they want to hear and what they want to believe is really good for everyone. And once you've got them, as Hitler used to say, once I appeal to their sense of altruism, they're mine. And so that's when I began to explore this idea of pathologies of altruism.
See, that's very, very interesting. There's a lot of things, components of this I want to discuss further. What's the level here then of how we collectively can be manipulated by having people in the positions of power and so forth appealing to our altruism and saying this is for the good of all and we have to go this way now. How often do you think this happens in the world, Barbara? I would say quite a bit, actually. I mean, we are being led one way or another, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's something that is so, it's seen everywhere around us. Every political party plays these kinds of games. And it doesn't matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, what you will believe is that it's the other side that's doing it. And your side may do it a little bit, but it's justified. And the other side does it a lot, and it's completely unjustified. And the reality is, both sides do it exactly equally, and you have to be careful, because if you drink the Kool-Aid, you are inadvertently, through your own efforts to do good, perhaps making things worse.
Absolutely, and there are many examples of this. We're going to get into this later. And what I want to point out as well before we head into that area, basically what is considered to be good and what then consequently is considered to be evil is, after all, subjective, is it not? I mean, what's altruistic to you might not be that to me because of the consequences of that. So this is a matter of perspective, correct?
It is perspective, but I do think that we need to be very careful. If we stop all judgment, then we allow regimes like the horrific regime of North Korea, we allow them to go on because we say, hey, look, well, people are alive. They're doing okay. It's all subjective anyway. I do think that it's important to look at different perspectives, but then in the end, draw back and realize that if you're too free and easy with what you'll accept, millions and millions of people can suffer horrendous lives and deaths because of that.
So what's your view when it comes to, I guess, stepping in and changing the course of, well, there's a number of ways we can look at this. We can look at it on the scale of the individual, on the family, and then the greater scale of countries and where countries are heading. Where do you think that we should draw the line? Where should other people come into the picture and say, now, no, you need to change this in your life? And what part should they be able to discover this for themselves and begin actively on their own to change the direction that they're heading in?
I think that it's the latter. What you just indicated as far as people stepping back and realizing on their own. Because if someone dictates from on high, it can so easily, inadvertently, turn into something that's pathologically altruistic. As soon as I start thinking I know better about what's really good, and I'm going to have you start doing it too, then that's a recipe for kind of a totalitarian, or however you want to put it, either side of the political spectrum, extreme right or extreme left,
yeah.
Either one is telling you how to think. So I think we need to kind of step back and just let people realize what some of the ramifications of what they're thinking can be.
Absolutely. I agree with that. I think that, if anything, people have to be in a position where they can discover for themselves and begin to change this. Because I've always argued, if they can be convinced, let's say they're on the right or whatever, and let's say they can be convinced to go over to the left a little bit, then what's going to prevent them from the next day encountering someone who's going to now convince them the opposite again? And they're just going to go back and forth like a pendulum, and they will never achieve any stability in their own life, right?
Yes. And in fact, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in relation to codependency. Codependency, your empathy is very high. You really feel for what others think. But what this can do is involve you in emotional contagion. So what everyone else thinks and their attempts to convince you of something can be made much easier if you're much more empathetic to others. So sometimes it is important to learn to turn off empathy so you can think more for yourself, and you're a little less influenced by people who are going to try and sway you one way or another.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, there are many examples of both people and nations and other groupings and organizations that think that they do good, but they actually do harm. And from across the board, historically, we could talk, as you did, about the Nazis in Germany, the communists in Russia. From even today, I mean, from my perspective, when I see some of these volunteer groups that go around in third world countries heading out, you know, Monsanto's GMO Terminator seed, you know, to poor farmers in less well-to-do places around the world. And this all comes from a perspective where they think that we're doing something that's good, but it's actually harmful. I'd like to hear a little bit more from your perspective, and maybe if you have a couple of other examples of this, Barbara, so people can get an understanding of how this dynamic works.
Well, a good example is my oldest sister, Carolyn. She, when she was 3 years old, she contracted polio. And it destroyed some of the most vital cells of her brain so that she was not only unable to walk without a severe limp, but she also had a great deal of difficulty focusing her attention. And why, and I'm going to wrap this back up into your question, why did kids in the 1940s get polio? And there were these huge polio epidemics all over the world. It was because of cleanliness. We had eradicated, we sort of got rid of a lot of diseases because we cleaned up the environment, and children were raised in this very nice, stable, clean, hygienic environment. But what we've seen as a result are epidemics of things, of diseases like polio, at least until we got inoculations, and also autoimmune diseases. There's so much by way of allergies and, you know, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, rheumatoid arthritis, just it lists after a vast list of autoimmune diseases that people have gotten. And certainly in our ancestral environment, people didn't go around sneezing all the time because they were allergic to things. So what is my point with all this? Efforts to do good actually produced a lot of disease inadvertently as the body began to attack itself, because the body's used to keeping off all sorts of parasites and viruses and so forth. And when you don't have those kinds of things acting on a system, the body attacks itself. Similarly, we have people who have great intentions and they really want to help other people. So when society starts getting into a stable, pretty good point, individuals will still keep looking for how they can help others. And sometimes it attacks some of the basic mechanisms of society itself inadvertently. But these efforts to help backfire and make things harder for everyone. So I do think that's what we're seeing sometimes in Europe today. For example, we see many different, like, I'm profoundly for great pay for teachers and great pay for policemen and great pay for janitors. But when all of these different groups go and say, look, we need great pay, by the time you add it all together, it starts taking the public coffers underwater. And so you're doing the right thing for everybody, but you're for each individual group, but overall you're doing the wrong thing because you're not stepping back and looking logically and saying, hey, wait a minute, this is more than we can really afford to pay, and our countries are going to start falling apart as a consequence because we're not laying things out rationally.
Yeah, see, that's a very, very interesting and important point. I've talked many times about, well, egalitarianism, would you consider that to be a sort of pathological altruism? Because, yeah, go ahead, Barbara.
I think it depends on whether you mean egalitarianism as in we think that the outcome should be shared among everyone, or egalitarianism, as in everyone has an equal shot at trying to do whatever they want to do. Those are two very different things.
Indeed. I mean, the second one is something I agree with. I think that that's the outlook. But if we talk about it from the perspective of the first one, then, that the outcome of whatever you put in, what everybody puts in, is going to be shared equally among everybody, although everybody might not put in equally into the system, if I can put it that way, right?
Yes. I'm such a strong proponent of everyone being treated fairly and well. And so in those lines, here's a relevant story. When I went to China, I'm a collector of Yixing teapots. They're absolutely beautiful. They're from this one little area of China that's got an extraordinary type of clay. So I'm a collector of Yixing teapots. And one teapot that I have in my collection is a very rare type, is called a revolution teapot. And the reason it's so rare is, well, for one thing, it's very ugly. When it was made was a period during the 1960s, 70s, right in there. It was, well, 50s, 60s. It was made during the Cultural Revolution. And what had happened then was all potters were told to create the teapots. But if any potter created a teapot that had more flair, more artistry, more beauty, that potter was killed because it was unfair for someone to have more talent than someone else.
Oh, boy. Yeah, there you go, huh?
So people don't realize. They say, that's impossible. That couldn't happen here. But they always say that. That's what they said in China. And the result was it can happen. So this well-meaning perspective can be carried to such an extraordinary event that you can't imagine sometimes what the outcomes can and are, what those outcomes can be.
Yeah, I've criticized the system that we have in Sweden for this very, you know, as of this very example that you bring up, actually, and obviously it's not as extreme in Sweden. There's no you know, public beheadings occurring if that's what happened in China or whatever. But the fact is that there is an ideal of egalitarianism here, which states basically that no one can achieve anything over anybody else. If they do, or if they are talented even at something, there is almost a tendency within society to frown on that person, to look down on the fact that they're now trying better than everybody else, and so the infrastructure for a natural talent of something isn't really there, because the idea is that everybody should be equal, and therefore it's not encouraged when these people come along and maybe they're just born and being very, very good at something. And so that, to me, Barbara, has been a very difficult thing to struggle with and deal with, because I haven't really understood that. And it's a similar thing that I exists in certain Asian cultures as well, that exists in the Nordic countries. There's actually a concept called the Jantelag. People can read about that. I've brought it up many times before. But so that's a very small-scale version of that. Is there anything similar in America, as far as I understand it? I mean, it's more – that's actually – the country, the culture is very much for encouraging the natural talents of people, correct?
It has been in the past, but I do think that under the current administration, which is a very well-meaning administration, I think that is changing some of the basic conceptions of this country. And some groups are deeply upset about that. They feel that that the bedrock of sort of people working independently to better themselves, that has not been, that's been being quashed under the current administration, and instead that a sort of a victim mentality is being encouraged. I do think that self-righteousness is really at the heart of all of this. And I think that cultures can inadvertently feed people who are self-righteous and allow them to come into positions of prominence, and that can be bad for everyone. Self-righteousness is very little studied in the neurological literature, but it's that feeling that you're helping others and you're right, and there's actually it's hypothesized that there's a dopamine connection in there in your reward system, that it's almost like a hit of heroin. Huh. You think you're helping others with your self-righteous attitude, and of course you can be absolutely dead wrong. You can in fact be making a society that is flat and that kills creativity, and of course that hurts everyone.
So it's a blind spot of sorts. State of your brain, if I can put it that way, we're not going to be able to see that whatever you're doing actually is harmful. Is that how it works? Or because, I mean, there's so many examples of this, right? People are absolutely 100% convinced that what they are doing is absolutely right. And that mindset overall can be very, very dangerous, can't it, Barbara?
It can be. In fact, I find this fascinating, is you can be, there's this narcissism locked into that kind of thinking, that it's a pattern where you think you're right and you can't really be dissuaded of it, because the only people you will, for one thing, you are influenced by other people, but you make sure that the people who you listen to and who you hang around with are only people who think just like you.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so then it's easy for you to say, well, everyone thinks that way, when it actually isn't true at all. And the bottom of it is you have so convinced yourself that the other side is dirty somehow, is they're associated with filth, they're racist, they're fascist, they're communist, whatever you want to, but you have them associated in your mind with filth. And so you can't be brought to listen to them because you've already emotionally decided that whatever they're saying is wrong.
Yeah, polarization. I think it's, that's one thing we're struggling with I think all over the world right now as well. It's incredibly polarized between the left and the right, and this is kind of, well, to me anyway, has been kind of a ridiculous paradigm, actually. And I think it's, well, see, a little bit later I want to get into how you see us remedy some of these situations, how, you know, some of your suggestions perhaps of how we can get out of this situation. So let's hold off a little bit more on that. But if we could for a moment go back to the image of the victim mentality that you talked about before, and look upon certain societies. In Sweden, for instance, we have a very big welfare state. And I've always wondered and questions, because again, there's a balance here. I 100% understand certain times the necessity of helping other people out. That's not what I'm saying at all. I wonder if the structure of it can look differently than it currently does. But the fact is, could there be a level of, let's see how I can put this, encouraging whatever the behavior is, of being dependent on the state, let's say, of not actually allowing people to get out of the situation that they're in, because there is a, within the system, there is a structure of a reward almost for what I'm saying is that it's preventing people from trying to get out of the situation they're in. Well, how do you view that, Barbara?
I agree, absolutely. Part of why I wrote the book Cold-Blooded Kindness, that's a book about a woman who she is a killer, and she may well be a serial killer. And this woman takes advantage of other people by portraying herself as a victim. For example, or her family. Her 13-year-old daughter was found with a lump on one of her breasts. So instead of just saying, okay, let's see what it is, she immediately went to all the news agencies and said, my daughter is dying of malignant breast cancer, and her dying wish is to get some emu chicks, you know, the little, they're sort of like ostriches. And, of course, it was she herself who wanted these emu chicks, but she couldn't afford them. So anyway, what happened? Well, it made all the news, and then she ended up a very nice breeder of emus gave her some emu chicks, or for her daughter. And so what? And it turned out her daughter just had a little lump, and it was actually nothing to even worry about. And she used that to portray herself as sort of this victim and to really take advantage of others because of it. So, and of course, that's just one little anecdote. She ended up killing her husband and then claiming that she did it in self-defense because he was attacking her. And actually, she said, he was coming straight at me, so I shot and killed him, but the bullet was in his back. So she takes advantage of all these perceptions among the public that women are often deeply abused, and sometimes they are, but it's a 50-50 thing, right? Women can abuse men just as well. Men are a little more powerful, so sometimes they can they have the advantage when it comes to physical violence. But this is not to say that a lot of women don't also beat their husbands. So at any rate, what I'm really trying to get across here is this idea that there, when you set up a system to help others, there are going to be a lot of people within that system who will take advantage of it. And the longer the system is in place, the more people will be encouraged to take advantage of it because they'll see other people successfully doing so. And so I think it's very important. See, if you're on the side that sets up systems like this, you'll automatically you'll discount people will take advantage of that kind of thing because you'll say, well, most people are really good. But the reality is there will be people who take advantage of it, but you'll ignore that and continue to go along those lines because you'll only be talking to people who feel like you do. And so you'll want to set up stronger and stronger systems like that. And, of course, that's a deeply pernicious mechanism in the long run.
In your view, is there any way that this can be prevented then? That there can be a system in place that is very beneficial to those who actually need the help, but that completely, weeds out those who are not supposed to be there and take advantage of it. I mean, in my view, that's impossible. That's never going to happen, right?
I think it is impossible. There will always be people who will take advantage of it, but the bottom line is you need the two different sides to talk to one another instead of to lambast one another and to work together. Really what you need is marriage counseling for politicians so they learn to talk to one another and appreciate their differences and make a system that works. And I think any system you have will be better if the politicians actually spoke to one another instead of sort of throwing stones.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, why don't we talk a little bit? I know you've talked before about the fact that we have two brain halves, right? We have the left brain and the right brain. We have a kind of a schism within us. This is actually then a reflection of what we have in politics, really, although it's a very simplified version or system of that. But the fact is there is an internal battle going on. And I think you've talked about before and referenced certain studies that have been made on those who lean a little bit more towards one side or the other, correct? And from looking at this, from studying this, we can learn about a greater cycle. We can learn about something greater in ourselves. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up because actually I've just completed a study of some 1,800 students And what I've done is correlated their political orientation with their degree of empathizing and their degree of what is called systemizing, which is sort of their rational approach. And the results, I think, are just fascinating. I mean, it's totally statistically significant, as they say. There is a big difference between the very liberal and the very conservative. And here's the essential difference. Well, there's a big difference between very liberal, very conservative, and moderates. Very liberal and very conservative are very high in systemizing. In other words, they think they've got good practical, I don't know if it's practical, but they have an analytical way of approaching the problem. Those who are moderate have lower analytical skills, you might say, but very liberal individuals have very high empathy, and very conservative have lower empathy. So you might think, that's great. Very liberal people are very high on empathizing, very high on systemizing. That's terrific. They've got high on all scales. They must be the guys who are right. But where you have to be careful is, if you're very empathetic, which one comes first? Very empathetic is sort of a stand-in for you don't use rationality. You leap to conclusions. You're afflicted with emotional contagion. Everything depends more on what other people think than on what you think.
Yeah.
Being very high in empathy can be not a very good thing. I mean, there's times when it's good, but there's times when it's bad. And which comes first? Do you make an emotional decision and then use your rationality to shore it up? Or do you start with rationality and then use your emotions? We don't know. But I think it was fascinating to just see the different personal characteristics of, on average, a very liberal person versus a very conservative person.
Yeah, it makes sense in a way, although obviously it's a simplified context. There's always a more problematic backdrop to this, I think, but overarching as an overview, I think it's actually correct. And so what part can we be, again, if we look at the emotional aspect of this, I mean, the fact is we are constantly being manipulated by marketing and everything else that appeal to our emotion, to try to bypass our rational mind and try to go straight in for the emotional shot to make you make a stupid purchase of things you don't really need, but it feels right for whatever reason, right? So how dangerous is this? How can we prevent from being manipulated by our emotions, if we can, Barbara?
It's really difficult. I think it is doable, but the first step is becoming aware of how you are being manipulated. When I'll talk to people who are strong partisans of one political party or another, it's virtually impossible to get them to read the perspectives or argue the opinions of the other party. The best way to understand another's perspective is to be able to argue that perspective as well as the other person can. What I often find is that people say, yeah, I do. I know what the other side is thinking, but it's actually a straw man. It's not at all what the other side is truly thinking, and they really cannot argue from the other side's position. But what people really don't understand is how, when they read something that supports their own position, they will pass over all the little subliminal emotional influences that are meant to sway you. And then when you read hundreds of these articles, you get this emotional certainty that what you're reading is correct, when it may not be correct at all. You've just been influenced by these hundreds of articles that all support your own position. And So I guess the first step is trying to be open about that and making yourself step back and try to really understand the other side.
Confirmation bias. Yep, you only go out and look for basically material that supports your already existing worldview. I mean, this is incredibly dangerous in a way. We have to look at the other side of the argument. We have to read things and listen to things and learn about things, watch things that are, I guess, goes against our own point of view, because then we also get challenged. Otherwise, we stagnate. And, I mean, there's so much to this and so much to this, why the state of the world and why mankind isn't in the rut that they're in right now, if you ask me. But what do you think people are afraid of? I mean, because to me, Barbara, this is a... I don't know if this is the right wording, but it's a sign of weakness in a way, that they're uncertain about their own point of view, so they do not want to encounter anything that might actually convince them otherwise. They might be afraid of losing this argument, or they might even be convinced and then have to change their mind. What do you think they're afraid of?
I would like to think that they're afraid, and that is possible. My sense is that there's so much emotional pleasure out of feeling that they're right, that they don't want to give that up. So it's really an addiction of self-righteousness, and that's what makes it tough to talk with someone about these kinds of matters. Sometimes I'm surprised, because have you ever seen that cartoon, and it says, it shows a bunch of equations on one side of a blackboard, and then a bunch of equations on the other side of the blackboard, and in the middle it says, and then a miracle happens. Sometimes I feel as if when I'm talking to someone about politics, you'll be talking brass, you know, just the bottom line facts. And when you're talking to the other person, they'll just kind of go, well, yeah, but we get there anyway. And they jump over. It's like, and then a miracle happens somehow. The government makes it happen or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's, and you can't argue with that, because they're, it's magical thinking, and you can't get at that kind of irrationality with logic.
Do you think that, and this is interesting, because I think everyone who's listening should try to apply this to themselves and their own point of view, their own perspective, and try to realize the potentiality. What if I am wrong in my point of view? What if that happens? Because there might be people listening and, yep, that applies to everybody else, but not to me, right? So this is very interesting. What do you do, Barbara, in order to try to stay balanced and honest, and in a sense, and actually try to see reality objectively instead of actually just supporting a worldview that you have? Because this is very difficult. We want to read things that support our worldview. We want to enforce that, correct?
Yes. I think the main thing I try to do is I try to read both sides and inform my own opinions as a result. And I try to never take as gospel some, like, if I'm reading something, you know, in the New York Times, sometimes I will talk to people, and the fact that it's in the New York Times, for a surprising number of people, that's enough for them to believe.
Yeah.
And it's not enough. I mean, people who write articles there are well-meaning people who have a particular worldview that they want you to buy into. It's natural. And unless you read different perspectives, very different perspectives, you won't see what they're leaving out and how things are inadvertently being swayed. I think the internet, for me, over the last, you know, couple or last decade in particular, has made me so profoundly aware of how you can read the same story from different perspectives. And what's shocking is that supposedly it will be from very good sources, and you'll have stories that completely contradict one another and from very ostensibly reputable sources. And it does make you much, much more aware of how people are being swayed and biased by the underlying perspectives of the journalists who are writing the stories. And remember that journalists do not get into the business because they want to tell the honest truth. Journalists get into the business because they want to help others. And that's profoundly different.
Now, this is very interesting. We're going to carry on here in the second segment here in a little bit. And much more to discuss. And obviously, I want to try to get closer to some of the answers, some of the possible solution, if there indeed is such a thing, for some of the problems that we're in and how we begin to move out of this situation. And going back to altruism again, just so much more to discuss here. But before we take a little break, Barbara, why don't we talk a little bit about your website? And obviously, I want to mention the book titles again. The one we've been talking about primarily here is called Pathological Altruism. And then, of course, if we go back a little bit in the series, if you will, of books, we also find Cold-Blooded Kindness and Evil Genes. And please, Barbara, let us know if there's any more titles that you have out there that kind of discuss this, and also give us then your website so people know where to go to read more about your books and pick up copies and so forth.
Oh, it's pretty easy to find me. I'm at www.barbaraoakley.com. And that gives my website is a pretty good overview of the different things I'm interested in. I'm very interested in the worldviews of, and I'm saying this because I have to kind of put things in a nutshell, but sort of left brain, right brain. And it's not really true that it's left brain and right brain, but it's a good, just quick nomenclature. And how we look and use left brain and right brain influences all sorts of different things. Now I'm looking at how do we learn math and science, and that is surprisingly deeply affected by which perspective we use.
Indeed, I have to get into that a little bit more also in the second hour. Pathological Altruism, do check it out, barbaraoakley.com. We're going to have the link up on Red Eyes Creations. .com as well, so you can go easily from our website over to Barbara's. But stay with us, we'll be right back with more.
What do you know about this?
Arrest me. I'll talk at the trial.
We don't have to wait for the trial to convict him. Howard Rourke is guilty by his very nature. It is whispered that he designed Cortland. What if he did? Society needed a housing project. It was his duty to sacrifice his own desires and to contribute any ideas we demanded of him on any terms we chose. Who is society? We are. Man can be permitted to exist only in order to serve others. He must be nothing but a tool for the satisfaction of their needs. Self-sacrifice is the law of our age. The man who refuses to submit and to serve, Howard Rourke, the supreme egoist, is a man who must be destroyed.
We have never learned to understand what is greatness in man. Self-sacrifice, we drool, is the ultimate virtue. Let's stop and think. Can a man sacrifice his integrity, his rights, his freedom, his convictions, the honesty of his feeling, the independence of his thought? These are a man's supreme possessions. To what must he sacrifice? To whom? Self-sacrifice? But it is precisely the self that cannot and must not be sacrificed. A man's self is his spirit. It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man above all. And where do we find it? In a man like Howard Rourke. Have that run off and set up on tomorrow's front page.
More is coming up with Barbara Oakley in the second hour. We are going to discuss evil genes and cold-blooded kindness. Barbara provides support for the idea that evil people act the way they do mainly as a result of a dysfunction. We'll talk about the Soviet Union, Obama, the welfare state, centralized systems, and groupthink. Two main questions we're trying to answer. Is kindness always the right answer? And should altruistic ideals be foisted upon everyone? We end the second hour talking about Ayn Rand and some of her ideas. To continue to listen, go to redeyesmembers.com and sign up for a membership if you haven't already. You can stream or download any of the programs. We have RSS feeds containing every single show going back to 2006. And of course, join the discussion and comment on any of the programs in our member section. More Red Ice Radio is coming your way soon. Next up, we have Marty Leeds, the mathemagician, with us. Then Katie Violas on RFID tracking and spy ships. And then Mark Gaffney on 9/11. We're also working on some really interesting roundtable programs as well. For now, thank you for listening, and of course, stay with us for more with Barbara Oakley.